Since its inception, Unitarian Universalism has had a tradition called freedom of the pulpit. Freedom of the pulpit means that any minister is free and, in fact, obliged to speak honestly and forthrightly as they see things without fear of reprisal from the congregation or from a larger governing body. This is very different than many faith traditions, and we need to be very clear that it is something worth noting. And it works both ways, or two ways, which is to say that along with that freedom to speak comes the freedom to listen, meaning you don't have to accept word one of anything that myself or anyone else who stands up here has to say. So that is in keeping with our democratic American ideals, and I just wanted to note that today before I begin. And I will begin my reflection with two short readings. The first we heard earlier, Choice, a found poem by Barbara Cogswell. Clever advocates preach to the choir with messages unattached to social reality. The next generation is the butt of this bad joke, stuck with a bill for excesses of power. Regain moral authority. Consign lies, wars, and torture to the dustbin. Democracy is a unique place where that can happen. A song with a melody we can sing to. All rise. Sing all the verses. We know the tune. The second excerpt, slightly adapted by me, comes from an essay by Jelani Cobb and is contained in the most recent issue of the New Yorker magazine. On April 8, 1968, members of Congress marched through downtown Memphis with Coretta Scott King, civil rights advocates Ralph Abernathy and Harry Belafonte, and thousands of people who had come to that city from across the country. 4 days earlier, Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot and killed there on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. And a fugue of disbelief and despair hovered over the crowd as it continued down the road that King had traveled. My hands aren't naturally blessed with much musical talent, but I have a sharp ear. And I'm struck by the contrasting musical metaphors of these two passages. Democracy is a unique place, a song with a melody we can sing to. And in King's civil rights era, millions of Americans of diverse colors, classes, and backgrounds stood as one to the call of all rise. They learned the tune and sang the verses as King and others conducted powerful strains of freedom and fairness, of expectation and equality, of generosity and joy, of brotherly and sisterly love for one's fellow human beings. Then, in one terrible instant, that song was subdued. King was dead. And in Jelani Cobb's musical imagery, a fugue of disbelief and despair hovered over the crowd. In 2009, the commemoration of Martin Luther King's life and work fell on January 19th, a day before the inauguration of the first African-American president. And Cobb writes that the proximity of those events suggested a kind of moral momentum, a verification that the will of democracy wins out in the long run. But, the author continues, next year, Donald Trump will preside over a holiday dedicated to a man whose principles he scarcely seems to comprehend. I want to say that again. Next year, Donald Trump will preside over the holiday dedicated to a man whose principles he scarcely seems to comprehend. And returning to my own words here, For many in our nation now, a similar fugue of disbelief and despair hovers over the land like a toxic funeral song. That noxious noise is perhaps loudest in North Carolina, which over the last several years has been fighting a political war over civil rights. Many of you know that the 2016 legislation known as House Bill 2 curtailed gay and transgender rights, but the Republican-led State Board of Election also implemented voter suppression practices that resulted in 158 less voting sites this past November than in 2014 or 2012. A practice that a court review said amounted to surgical racism. The courts have also said that the legislature must redraw its voting districts and hold a new election next year, it's normally every 2 years, because the redistricting was so unfair that the legislature is unconstitutionally constituted. And now that Democrat Roy Cooper was narrowly elected governor, the past month has been the scene of a political power grab so egregious that some commentators have called it a legislative coup. For instance, Republicans are trying to subvert his ability to choose his own cabinet by making appointments subject to Senate approval because they don't want Cooper to put people in place who threaten their policies. Another bill, which was quickly signed by departing Republican Governor Pat McCrory, strips future governors of their power to appoint a majority to the State Board of Elections. The bill also makes it harder for the losers of some Superior Court cases to appeal directly to the Supreme Court, which has a liberal-leaning majority. In short, they lost a gubernatorial election, so now they're rapidly changing the rules of the game in their favor. But in the midst of all this, the spirit of Martin Luther King lives. Certainly not just in one person, but it lives large in the Reverend Dr. William Barber II. Barber is a Protestant minister and political leader in North Carolina and a member of the National Board of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He's also president of Repairers of the Breach, an organization that takes its name from verse 12 of the biblical book of Isaiah. Those from among you will rebuild the ancient ruins. You will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the streets in which to dwell. In 2013, Barber began leading regular Moral Mondays protests in North Carolina's capital city of Raleigh. Moral Mondays are a recurring set of vigils at which mostly black civil rights activists from poor coastal communities and mostly white wealthy environmentalists from towns like Chapel Hill have joined forces to advocate for immigrant and LGBTQ rights, criminal justice equity, environmental protection, and other issues, and with a constancy that has drawn national attention. It includes the involvement of many Unitarian Universalist ministers and laypersons. Barber has also been traveling the nation calling for a moral revival, similar to the revolution of values that Martin Luther King preached on April 4, 1967, a year to the day before he was killed. Here's King. "We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." But neither in North Carolina nor in the nation as a whole does that tyrannical triad hold the final word. And we hear King's prophetic echo in a speech William Barber gave last July. "There are some issues that are not left versus right, liberal versus conservative. They are right versus wrong. We need to embrace our deepest moral values and push for a revival of the heart of our democracy." Barber referred several times to this image of America's failing heart. And I know many of you feel the stabbing constrictions, as do I. But Barber said it is us who must set things right and bring the healing. We are being called, he says, like our forefathers and foremothers, to be the moral defibrillators of our time. We must shock this nation with the power of love. We must shock this nation with the power of mercy. We must shock this nation and fight for justice for all. We can't give up on the heart of our democracy, not now, not ever. In a quieter moment, Barber also reflected in an interview about what the battles in North Carolina mean, because there were ultimately many victories that had led to the recent desperate grasps for power. In his words, it's a sign of things to come when we organize in the South. And so the governor and those extremists did everything they could. They even purged votes during the election, but they lost again, and we forced votes to be put back on the books. So they have seen that they have tried everything, and when there is a movement of the people, a moral movement of the people, we can in fact change the South. And if you do that, you change the nation. And so now with these issues, with these losses, they are now engaging in this extreme power grab and policy grab. But we have a movement here, and that movement has been working for years, and particularly over the last 3 years with Moral Mondays. We were able to change the consciousness of the state. We were able to change the consciousness of the state. That to me is an amazing statement. Because there will always be those, even those charged with upholding the constitutional rights of the citizenry, who can't seem to grow beyond the deafening din of their own egos and fears and prejudices and self-absorption. But when the consciousness of enough people is raised, when the awareness of interconnectedness takes root and expands in the mind and the heart, when people who have up to now had a very narrow definition of self-interest realize that in Martin Luther King's words, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny, and that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. When that happens, the world changes. Not completely, but significantly. Not perfectly, but sometimes surprisingly swiftly. In his book, My Soul Is Rested, The Story of the Civil Rights Movement in the Deep South, author Howell Raines, collected a number of oral histories from those times. A man named Hartman Turnbow said this: "Anybody had told me before it happened that conditions would make this much change between the white and the black in Holmes County, Mississippi, here where I live, why, I'd have just said, you're lying. It won't happen. I just wouldn't have believed it. I didn't dream of it. I didn't see no way. But it got to working, just like the citizenship class teacher told us, if we would register to vote and just stick with it. He says it's going to be some difficulties. He told us that when we started. We was looking for it. He told us, said we're going to have some difficulties, going to have troubles. Folks going to lose their homes. Folks going to lose their lives. Folks going to lose all their money. And just like he said, all of that happened. He didn't miss it. He hit it, kadap, on the head. And it's working now. It won't never go back where it was." Hartman Turnbow had heard the fugue of disbelief and despair his entire life. And he was adamant, it won't happen. Then it did. Not completely, but significantly. Big positive changes can emerge. Kadap! Look at the speed at which marriage equality became the law of the land. On April 3, 1968, in a packed Pentecostal church in Memphis, Tennessee, the Reverend Samuel Billy Kiles was just a few feet away from Martin Luther King. King was addressing the injustice suffered by the city's sanitation workers who were on strike protesting low pay and poor working conditions. But that night, King went far beyond that subject. "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Said Reverend Kiles, there had been so many death threats against his life, especially since he had come out against the war in Vietnam. And we were just standing there. It was like, what did he know that we didn't know? King was assassinated the next day. When Reverend Kiles, who still preaches in Memphis, speaks to people who weren't alive or who were too young to remember King, he says, he tells them, "We're not going to get to the place where we can say Dr. King's dream has been realized. Now we can go to the beach. That's not going to happen. But each generation will have its portion, and that helps us to keep the dream alive. Each generation will have its portion. Each generation, this generation, will have its part in the resounding chorus of justice, in reviving the ailing moral heart of this country, in singing the songs that keep the dream alive. Democracy is a unique place where that can happen. A song with a melody we can sing to. In King's days, those melodies included the moving refrains of We Shall Overcome. The times they are a-changing. Change gonna come. We shall not be moved. Lift every voice and sing." So even though the haunting strains of Frédéric Chopin's Familiar Funeral March, or today let me call it a foul funeral fugue, may be playing in the background of our precious nation like the most horrid Muzak ever, I need to say to you, all rise in body or in spirit. Sing all the verses. We know the tune. Please rise. We're going to reprise the song we just sang. I'm going to call out the lyrics. You can leave your hymnals at your sides. And we're going to sing it a little differently, a little quicker, a little louder, a little more spirited. Circle round for freedom.
Let's start some more, Bill. We'll follow Peter.
That's good, too. Round for freedom.
Circle round for freedom.
Circle round for peace.
Circle round for peace.
For all of us imprisoned.
For all of us in prison.
Circle for release.
Circle for release.
Circle for the planet. Circle for each soul.
Circle for each soul.
For the children of our children.
For the children of our children.
keep the circle whole.
Keep the circle whole.
Circle round for freedom.
Circle.
Take the hand of the person next to you.
Freedom.
Circle round for peace.
Circle round for
connect with your neighbor. For all of us in prison. Circle for release.
Circle for release.
We are in this together. Circle for the planet.
Circle for the planet.
You are not alone. Circle for each soul.
Circle for each soul.
We're all connected for the children of our children.
Children of our children.
Keep the circle whole.
Circle.
Keep the circle. Circle round for freedom.
Circle round for freedom. Circle round for peace. For all of us in prison. Circle for release.
Circle for the planet.
Circle for the planet.
Circle for each soul.
Children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom. Circle round for peace. For the children of us in prison, circle for release.
Could remain connected for one moment, and as you do so, think and commit to one action that you will take to help keep the circle whole in these troubled times. One commitment, whether it's a one-time event, whether it's an ongoing practice, whether it's connecting, joining another organization. Whatever you can do to take your heart and your soul and ground it into the world, commit to that now. This is a sacred space, and that is a sacred act. And when we take it together, we have even more power than if we were to take it alone. Take a moment and breathe into that commitment. If it doesn't come to you right away, that's okay. Just commit by the end of the day to writing it down. Putting it on your calendar, putting it on your to-do list, making it happen. One thing, right now. And one more time, a cappella.
Circle round for freedom.
Circle round for peace.
Circle round for peace.
For all of us in prison.
For all of us in prison.
Circle for release.
Circle for release.
Circle for the planet.
Circle for the planet.
Circle for each soul.
Circle for each soul.
For the children of our children.
For the children of our children.
Keep the circle whole.
Keep the circle whole.
Amen and blessed be.